Today on Wings, the dramatic conclusion of the Stolen Revolution, Iranian Women of 1979, and today.
It's no joke. For 40 years straight, these women have fought every hour of every day for their demands, for their personal freedom, and against the mandatory hijab.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
This two-part Wings series, The Stolen Revolution, was produced by Donya Ziai for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's program series, Ideas. The terms of our license to rebroadcast include keeping the original narration. Here is Ideas host, Paul Kennedy.
The Iranian Revolution of 1979, a year in which history failed to turn. Iranian women were at the forefront of the revolution, but after the Shah was deposed and Ayatollah Khomeini returned to the country, everything they'd been fighting for was threatened. And the story of their resistance has been written out of the official revolutionary narrative. That's why on the 40th anniversary of their protests, CBC radio producer Donya Ziai talks to three women who were there, on the streets of Tehran, fighting to take back their revolution. We're calling this episode The Stolen Revolution, Iranian Women of 1979.
In last week's episode, I introduced you to Haideh Daragahi. She was a professor of literature in Tehran at the time of the Iranian Revolution and now lives in Sweden. One week after the revolution, Haideh was busy organizing one of several commemorations of March 8th, International Women's Day. But on March 7th, Ayatollah Khomeini decreed that women now had to wear the veil in government offices. And what were meant to be celebrations of Women's Day turned into massive protests. Haideh joined tens of thousands of other women on the streets of Tehran. Here she is again.
The question of women's rights, like all other democratic rights, were not on the agenda of the left. They were very abstract slogans, but because we had lived under a dictatorship, we had never discussed these issues. But women, almost by instinct, knew what this means. And they were the first group to protest. And some of the slogans, that placards that went up the day after, and the slogans that the women chanted, showed that they were the most progressive and the most conscious group of society. But the most important one that applied far more to than just to the women was ma inqilab nakardim ta be aqab bargardim. We did not make a revolution to go backward. The other one that was very interesting, because they were being accused of helping the West, was azadi na sharqist na gharbist jahanist. Freedom is neither from the West or from the East. It's universal. These slogans are still relevant in Iran.
Yeah.
40 years ago, they knew what they were saying.
And a lot of this seemed to be really spontaneous, was it not? All these protests and these slogans, they came together sort of word of mouth?
This was totally spontaneous. It was not ordered or organized by any political group or even by the women themselves. They just came out on the streets in protest. The only people we could have any hopes of were leftist organizations. They were taken aback. They were taken by surprise. And they didn't know what to do with that phenomena. It was not written down in their pamphlets or in their party agendas. They paid lip service to the equality of men and women. But they never knew what it means in reality. There was no question in our mind that this is the first step to suppress and we should stand up to it. Both as women, as revolutionaries, as Iranians who wanted change. And immediately after that, we started feeling that this horrible combination of restrictions is standing above our heads like a sword that would cut us up soon. There was no doubt in our minds that we should stand up to it.
And they did stand up to it.
Today, more than 10,000 women poured into the streets. Some Iranian men, presumably male chauvinist pigs, attacked them and called them prostitutes.
For 6 days straight, the women marched, despite the violence they'd faced on the streets. They occupied the Ministry of Justice, where they staged a sit-in and read out a declaration of their rights and demands. And in one of the biggest final protests, almost 15,000 women gathered outside the National Radio and Television headquarters.
And the women claimed that their protests had been virtually ignored by government-controlled broadcasting stations here. Iranian television stations showed no picture of this demonstration at the Justice Ministry on Saturday.
They were there to protest a man named Sadeh Qutbzadeh. He'd been a close aide to Khomeini throughout the Ayatollah's years in exile, and he was by then the director of radio and television, where he'd been busy purging the airwaves of royalists, leftists, and women.
We didn't hear about it at all from television. We didn't see any of the demonstration, even in the newspapers. Whatever we read this morning was exactly opposite we did yesterday.
When state television did report on women's protests, it accused them of being idolaters or prostitutes, showing pictures of women in fur coats and large sunglasses. And on the streets, women continued to be attacked by counter-protesters, or more accurately, chanting mobs. The attackers assaulted the women with knives, stones, bricks, and broken glass, while the regime's police did nothing.
This women's march through downtown Tehran was watched with suspicion and was blocked by a small but angry group of men who shouted, "Magbay Communist, death to the communists."
The only thing protecting the women was a chain of male allies who'd linked up arms to shield them. The protesters also found allies among feminists from other countries.
United States feminist Kate Millett, author of Sexual Politics, branded the Ayatollah Khomeini a chauvinist pig and led the demonstration today that was 20,000 strong.
Kate Millett had been invited to Tehran by student activists she'd met in the United States.
Well, I think it's wonderful. It's a spontaneous uprising of thousands and thousands of women, which would have been absolutely inconceivable in the West.
They also had support from a militant French feminist collective called Psychoanalysis and Politics. The group produced a 12-minute film of what they saw.
Nous, les femmes du mouvement de libération des femmes, pratique politique et psychanalyse.
That short documentary, called Year Zero, remains the only existing film of that week's events. The women's protests soon forced the regime to back down on the mandatory veil rule, at least for a while.
It wasn't just the Iranian left that was taken by surprise, the male part of it anyway. It was also the Islamic Republic. They never expected something like that. So the newspapers started reflecting a lot of these people, not Khomeini himself, but other mullahs, especially Taleghani, who was popular with the left, to come and say that there is no obligation for wearing the veil. They took it back.
Ayatollah Taleghani was a high-ranking theologian and one of the architects of the revolution. Just a few days after March 8th, he said that Khomeini's statements about veiling had been misunderstood, that they were intended just as advice, the kind a father might give to his children. The hijab, Taleghani said, would not be imposed. And with that, the street protests started to fizzle out.
The women's liberation movement has embarrassed Iranian officials.
Why do you think that the religious forces backed down at that point?
You see, when a government has come to power on the shoulders of a revolution as big as the Iranian revolution, they had absolutely no instruments of control. Because they did not have that, they took it back. But then they started in a creeping way by forcing women under the threat of losing their jobs. So it took 2 years to enforce the veil.
You know, when people talk about the Iranian Revolution and its aftermath, they don't often talk about women's protests and resistance in March 79 and after. Why do you think it's important to remember?
Because we should remember from our mistakes. We did not organize immediately afterwards. There was no organized opposition to bring them to their knees. That is what we should have recognized. That is what we should have done. We didn't do that.
But there were some attempts by women to continue organizing in the days just after the revolution. Before the early 1980s, when the regime's crackdown on the opposition really got violent, there was a brief flourishing of women's associations in the workplace, women-specific committees and political organizations, and even autonomous women's organizations independent of the government or any political parties. Shaheen Navoi was one of those organizers.
My name is Shaheen Navoi. I live in Berlin, Germany. I'm an activist in the women's movement and a researcher in the field of entomology.
So, Shaheen, when you look back to the protests that started on March 8, 1979, and the week that followed, what do you remember the most about participating in those protests with so many other women?
When
I think back to those days, I remember most of all the passion and excitement of the women who came to the streets for days and days. They were filled with energy to declare their opposition to the mandatory hijab. We thought that it was important that the regime temporarily back down, but I didn't personally have much hope that this was the end of the story. It was also a sad time for all of us because we weren't getting much support from the political, literary, or intellectual world in Iran at the time. There was, of course, some international support from other women, but that solidarity didn't have much impact inside Iran in those days. That's why the most important question facing us then was whether we should start doing the organizing ourselves, to try to continue our fight to get more rights, and to not allow the rights that we already did have to get trampled on.
You yourself had been sympathetic to the left and, you know, leftist organizations throughout the revolution and afterwards. What was the most common reaction that you heard from those on the left in relation to the women's protests?
The dominant reaction was that they objected to women getting attacked in the protests. But they didn't clearly and explicitly support women's demands, although they didn't negate them either. But our expectation in those days was for the whole political movement at that time to stand up firmly and decisively in support of women's demands. And sadly, that didn't happen.
You decided, with some others, to found the National Union of Women, or the NUW. What was the turning point for you that prompted you to start this organization?
Before March 8th, myself and some friends, who had actually met completely by chance, had been preparing to establish an independent women's organization. We had prepared a statement to distribute on March 8th. But on that day, the crowds were so huge that we couldn't actually follow through.
So we published that statement later in a newspaper and invited people to come. A huge group of people came to the hall we'd rented. They all expressed interest in the idea of an organization, but no one had any actual experience in organizing. We decided anyway to try and get started, even at just a rudimentary level, because there was going to be a referendum then. People were voting on the Islamic Republic. And so we tried to establish our organization, the National Union of Women, as soon as possible, so that we could take our first official political position. We announced the group's establishment on March 28, 1979. And on April 1st, the same day as the national referendum, we announced that we were against the referendum and that we were against the Islamic Republic.
What were your fears about an Islamic Republic?
The truth is, we had no idea what the substance of it would be. Not just us. Nobody did. They hadn't announced anything whatsoever about the content of it. But based on the news and political events of the past, it was clear to us that religious rule was coming, and we weren't willing to be subjected to religious rule under any circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Can you take me into those early days, one of those first meetings after you set up an office?
We immediately rented an office near the University of Tehran. Anyone who was interested could come by. And from the first day onwards, we'd sit around and talk about how to organize ourselves. When we first opened our office, we didn't have any resources. We truly started out with nothing. And in all of our meetings, which lots of people would attend, we'd all be sitting on the floor, and all we had was one desk and a few chairs.
The National Union of Women may have started modestly, but their work was ambitious, and their goals were huge. They supported women facing expulsion from work for refusing to wear the veil. They campaigned against proposed changes to regressive gender laws in the Constitution. They worked to oppose Sharia laws on retribution. And they launched literacy and awareness-raising campaigns in working-class neighborhoods and small towns.
So what was it ultimately that led to the downfall of the National Union of Women?
We were forced to close our office at our first location. This was 8 months after the revolution, and there were attacks on various organizations. They'd also shut down a bunch of newspapers. And since we were in a very high-traffic area, we decided to relocate to a new neighborhood where our office would be more protected. We continued there for as long as it was possible to operate in a relatively open way. But after a while, it became risky, and we decided to shut down our office. We had a number of unpleasant and suspicious interactions and decided it was too dangerous and that it's better to stop until the right conditions are in place again. But unfortunately, to this day, the right conditions still don't exist for us.
And what did you do with all of the connections you'd made, all of the women who had come forward and signed up to be a part of your group? What happened to all of that?
A lot of people had approached us. We had so many members. And when things started to feel unsafe, the sad thing was that we didn't have the ability to keep these lists somewhere secure. And since I was in charge of communications and kept all those lists, I had to burn all of them, one by one, overnight, in a safe location. These were membership cards, and they had all the personal information, addresses, telephone numbers, of all the members of the National Union of Women and others who had shown an interest. And I had to destroy all of them because we were worried that even if one sheet of paper somehow got in the hands of the police, someone would get hurt.
What did it feel like to do that?
All I did was cry. It was so painful. It's still so painful to this day when I think about it. That whole time, I just carried this huge sadness and tears in my eyes. We had no choice, and it was so agonizing. It symbolized all we'd done, day in and day out. These were all records and testimonies. And when I burnt them, I would just see, right in front of my eyes, the faces of each and every single one of my dear friends.
Shaheen, when was the moment when you realized you have to leave Iran?
It was when they attacked my home and raided my workplace. Luckily, I wasn't home, but I realized things were really serious now, and I was forced to live underground in Iran for months. It was really difficult. Under no circumstances could I visit my family. I had some distant friends who weren't connected to anything I was affiliated with, and I contacted them, and they took me in and let me live in their homes for a while. But these were very difficult months. I would see my sister's husband once a week, and he'd give me some of the things I needed. He'd give me money or we'd exchange news. But other than that, I had absolutely no contact with any of my loved ones until I finally left Iran. Sadly, I never did manage to see my mother. 2 years after I left Iran, my mother got very ill. And until the very end, we never had the chance to see each other and say goodbye.
When you look now at what's happening inside Iran and at the status of women in Iran now, what goes through you?
I'm really glad to see where women inside Iran are at right now. These 40 years of everyday resistance have taught them so much. The level of consciousness about feminism among women is so much higher than when I was in Iran. It's no joke. For 40 years straight, these women have fought every hour of every day for their demands, for their personal freedom, and against the mandatory hijab. It's impossible to imagine Iran without the resistance of these women. Iran would be nothing more than a graveyard.
In December 2017, a young woman by the name of Vida Movahed climbed on top of a utility box on one of Tehran's busiest streets. And she stood there, bareheaded, calmly waving her white scarf on a long stick. Her display of defiance went viral, and photos soon started circulating of other Iranian women taking off their headscarves in public. Dozens were arrested, but these women were undeterred. Together, they became known as Daughters of Revolution. Minu, Haideh, and Shaheen all told me it's been heartening for them to see that the torch they lit 40 years ago is still being carried by Iranian women of this generation. But I couldn't help but wonder, looking back now at the 1979 revolution and seeing how women in Iran are living now, would they still have participated in the revolution?
Against the Shah's regime? Yes. And going back, it doesn't mean that I want this regime. No. I want something better. But that doesn't mean that that revolution was wrong. No, that revolution was inevitable. And we hoped that we could steer it. We were wrong. And the clergy hijacked it, deceived us, and deceived many people.
Participating in a revolution isn't a question of choice. Revolution is a truly unique moment. I think if another revolutionary moment were to transpire today, I would definitely approach it with much greater awareness. With what I know today, I'm not as naive as I once was.
Because these people have come to power on the shoulders of a revolution, they are very much aware what the meaning of organization on the popular level means. So they do everything to stop that. They have managed so far for 40 years. How much longer they will be in power, I don't know. But I know that the political sophistication of Iranian society is far, far beyond what the Islamic Republic is about. That discrepancy will be the end of this regime.
Thank you so much. واقعاً ممنونم که شرکت کردید.
Thank you, عزیزم.
I really learned a lot from you. Thank you.
خواهش میکنم عزیز.
خیلی ممنون از شما.
Bye bye. خداحافظ.
خداحافظ.
Listening to The Stolen Revolution, Iranian Women of 1979. The episode was produced by Donya Ziayi. You can see images from the 1979 women's resistance in Iran on our website, cbc.ca/ideas, where you can always download our podcast or stream us. Special thanks to Tina Verma for her voiceover help. Liz Nage is the associate producer of Ideas. Technical production, Danielle Duval. Greg Kelly is the executive producer of Ideas, and I'm Paul Kennedy.
That was the second of two parts of the program, The Stolen Revolution, Iranian Women of 1979. You can find part one on the website wingsradio.org, and you can hear the whole hour on the website cbc.ca/radio/ideas. Thank you to CBC for relicensing this content to Wings, and to the producer Donya Ziayi for making the program and dividing it for Wings use. Donya Ziayi was previously in the PhD program in Gender, Feminist, and Women's Studies at York University. She left to become a journalist for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. She hails from Toronto and Tehran. Wings thanks all our supporters, including the International Association of Women in Radio and Television, Dr. Carolyn Byerly, WERUFM, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the new book, The Maternal Roots of the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer, Frida Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.